FW presents Panel by Panel, the show that dissects a single comic book panel from the last 85 years of comics history. Each episode, I'm Siskoid, and our panelist today is Andrew Leyland, who you may know from the Fantasticast, and that's going to be relevant. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, who you may or may not know. Who can say?
Now you do. Now you know. He is one of the hosts of the Fantasticast. And I invited Andrew specifically because I needed a Fantastic Four expert.
And he couldn't find one, so.
He was the closest one, 4 hours difference away. Because the Fire and Water Podcast Network is sort of taking credit for a new book that Marvel is publishing called Fantastic Four Number One. Panel by panel. It celebrates 60 years of the FF. It's a unique, not so unique as I come to find out, collection. Comes out in November of this year, deconstructs Stan Lee and Jack Kirby's seminal comic, oversized and remastered, one panel per page, or it seems to say so, extending a 25-page comic into a 260-page hardcover that also includes in-depth commentary by, among others, Kirby friend and biographer Mark Evanier. And it sounds a lot like this show, and it's called Panel by Panel, but I was talking to Andrew just before, and Marvel's already done a book like this some 15 years ago.
Yes, they have. It was called Maximum FF. It was a hardcover volume by Walter Mosley. It has essays in it by Mosley and Mark Evanier, and it is exactly what you describe this new book to be. It is the Fantastic Four. Panel by panel, each page of this book is a separate panel. So the introductory splash page is four pages of the figures of the Fantastic Four in the regulation guise. And then the next two-page splash is the underside of that, which is the Fantastic Four flame over the New York skyline. And then the first panel is on the next page. And it goes on and on and on. And in some cases, there are even fold-outs. So the scene where Mr. Fantastic leaps out and catches Johnny as he falls because his flame fails is a four-page fold-out.
Wow.
So, this does exist in some form. I presume they're going to carry on and dissect other comics like this.
Maybe, yeah. And I think like the one that's supposed to come out in November, from what I've read, has more in-depth. It certainly has different essays. Mark Evanier is also part of the package, of course. But they seem to say they will go in-depth on each panel. That's not clear. But also that they've used a photographer to capture the images from the original comic. So I don't know. Does Maximum FF, is it recolored?
I can't say that it's recolored, no. And okay. One of the issues that I have with it is some of the panels are blown up to be over two pages. And in that particular case, the line work doesn't really hold up to that level of magnification.
I see. Because I know like the coloring for me is very different, and we'll see it once we roll a panel. Blues are lighter in the recolored versions, the slick paper ones. You don't get like that dot matrix, CMYK, whatever, color things. So the colors are more opaque, but all the colors are generally brighter, but it makes them lighter in some sense. And I feel like it robs the panels of some atmosphere in recolored versions. Like I'm looking at the Marvel Masterworks.
Yeah.
I just don't have the cash on hand to buy the original issue.
You mean Fire and Water doesn't pay you enough to afford an original copy of Fantastic Four number one?
That's right. And there'll be an announcement for our Patreon at the end. So.
Well, it's interesting you should talk about that just this week, to be tangential, but this is a comic book podcast. I was listening to Ed Brubaker on Word Balloon talking about his new release, Reckless. And he talked about how he and Sean Phillips discussed the paper stock they would like those books to be printed on, what best suits his art and Jacob Phillips's colours. And he said he would look at them, and what you see is there is a difference in colour quality from the ones that are printed early on in the print run to the ones that are printed later on in the print run. And everything's the same. The paper stock's the same. There's no difference. But there's just something about as it gets along, the paper that they chose to use soaks the colour up slightly. So there's all, yeah, so that when you were talking about the colours being different, so obviously, yeah, the dot matrix printer dots are no longer there. But this idea that the colouring can be affected not only by the printing, not only by the paper stock, but by the length of the print run, I found fascinating, because I'm as big a geek as anybody, so I was genuinely interested in that.
Yeah, let's see that first one. Like, if they were numbered like prints, you could have like look at number one and look at number whatever.
Yeah, and see the difference. Yeah,
I mean, you've got the kind of the product in hand. You can see what it looks like if a comic is deconstructed this way. Because obviously, Jack Kirby is drawing from the top of the page to the bottom of the page, and each page is a unit of storytelling. Like, good artists know how to lay out a page, but once you remove the page from it and you're just looking at panels, does that panel still work? And that's a little bit what this show tries to discuss, without making a claim that the page and layout is also an important factor in your reading of comics, you know. So reading a comic panel by panel in the way that the book you have in hand does, or, you know, and there's some, I don't know, there's like CD-ROM comics that kind of tried to do that, where you could, you know, read comics without getting spoiled what was happening later. Is that a viable comic book format? Especially when you're converting something that was never meant to be seen that way. What do you think?
I don't know that it is in this particular case, because like you say, it is equivalent to the ye olde way of putting films on television with pan and scan.
Mm-hmm.
It's not how it was designed to be seen. The picture frame is missing certain elements. And it's the same in this book. Now, I presume it's something they will correct in the new book, but there are panels in this book where they've zoomed in on them to emphasize a certain point of the panel, but at the expense of cropping the image. And I don't really like that, because obviously, I mean, clearly Kirby never intended for FF1 to be read in this manner anyway. But at the same time, to then go and crop that image further, I think really dilutes the impact of some of the artwork. Like, there are certain pages, like where it becomes the mole man story in this book, it becomes a two-page splash, the mole man's secret. But it's cropped in such a way that the first caption box, before we witness the breathtaking conclusion of our amazing tale, all of the letters over on the far left are trimmed. So you've not got B4, you've got a number 3 E4. And no. It doesn't work, because you're not getting the story as was, and you can't read it properly. Like I said, I presume the new version will fix that. I don't see the point of publishing something that's cropping things.
No, I agree. If we take just one panel out of context, is that an objet d'art in a way? Does that become, in itself, the smallest unit of comic book storytelling? Does that still work? And that's what we're going to try to prove or disprove today by basically rolling for a random panel in this and seeing if it has value, and then discussing it, you know, its merits. So I've dusted off the old randomizer. There hasn't been a show in more than a year. It's a little dusty. And normally we'd be rolling a year and a comic from that year, but we already know that. It's going to be Fantastic Four number 1 on sale in August of 1961. But still, we must roll for a page and a panel. So it's going to be page 10 of 25. And our 6 panels on that page, we get panel number 4. Number 4. And you'll find, I'll put that panel up in the show notes at fireandwaterpodcast.com so you can pore over it yourselves. So are we happy with that choice? Is this a good panel for us to get?
Yes, because it's right in the midst of the origin. Now, one of the interesting things about Fantastic Four number 1 is its structure. It doesn't start with the origin. It starts with an unrelated tale in many ways. And then in the middle of the issue, they tell you the origin story. So the panel you've picked is smack dab in the middle of the origin story. And it's the moment where the Fantastic Four are bombarded with the cosmic rays that ultimately give them their powers. Now, in Maximum FF, the word balloons are missing.
Oh.
This is one of the panels that I've talked about where they've cropped it. It is a two-page splash in Maximum FF, so you can really analyze what's going on. But the first dialogue balloon, which is, as you've sent it through to me, my head, it's pounding as though it's about to burst, is completely missing. But the tail of the word balloon is there. Johnny's dialogue was, Ben was right. We should have waited. Should have gotten heavier shielding. Only the word shielding is there. So it's a terrible crop job in Maximum FF that I hope they will fix in the upcoming one. In terms of panel pertaining to what you were talking about earlier, the color on the digital panel is brighter. The reds are brighter. The blues are brighter. It's a darker blue in Maximum FF.
That's the original coloring. Yeah.
The panel itself is really exciting because you're looking at it going, well, out of context, you don't know what's happening here. You can gather from the dialogue they're being pelted with something, but you don't know what. And it's these two figures, you don't know who they are, just being bombarded with these lines, which we know are cosmic rays, but just looking at this individually, you wouldn't know that. And as so, it's quite a striking panel in and of itself. The colour scheme, the pink background of the cosmic rays, with the figures are all completely red to denote something dangerous is happening. At the forefront of the image is some typical Kirby technology that's bright blue, which kind of offsets the danger feel of the panel. But yeah, I think in and of itself, that one panel stands alone because as a reader, it makes you look at it and go, I want to know what's happening here.
I mean, historically, if we put it in context, this may be the beginning of the Marvel Universe in a way, because it's the moment of origin. Like the panel before this, to spoil it, the panel,
spoil the 60, 70 year old comic,
or spoil the illusion of this being a discrete, image. The panel before this is the cosmic rays kind of pelting the ship itself. And then the panel after this, there are no more cosmic rays. It's Johnny starting to burst into flame. The next one after that is Ben Grimm on the floor, super heavy. But there are none of these lines. I've always loved these cosmic rays things that look like, I don't know, like really thin lozenges or something. Yeah, I like it. So, but there are only two panels where you see the rays. The one where there's the ship, but you don't know that the characters are going to be in danger because of this. And then this one where they are actually being pelted. So this is the first time and this the Marvel origin story happens, which is to say radiation is the cause of getting powers. And it's going to happen to a lot of heroes, and it's going to happen to a lot of fetuses, if we take the mutants into account, yep. I guess. But, you know, moment zero for the Marvel Universe in a way.
Yeah, in every way, it is ground zero for the Marvel Universe. And the problem is, though, I think you may have done a disservice by having me on this one, because I can't take this out of context. I have read this issue numerous times. I know what the panel before and after is. So it was kind of an interesting thought experiment to take myself out of that and just look at the panel you sent me.
Yes, well,
and see what I thought of it.
One question that comes to mind, even with context, is which figure is which? Who are these two people? Each one has a dialogue balloon. I wondered if you could tell who was who.
Only from the dialogue. The figure at the forefront of the panel said Ben was right.
Right.
So clearly that's not Ben. Now, we don't know who it is. We don't know that it's Johnny, Reed, or Sue from that. It could be any of them. It's doubtful that it's Reed. It's doubtful that Reed is acknowledging that somebody else was more correct than he was. He kind of strikes me as a guy who has a healthy ego, and therefore that's unlikely to be him. My feeling is that's Sue and Johnny.
Okay. I had a different take. But it's basically in context, we then see a panel of Johnny, we then see a panel of Ben. So I was thinking, and obviously Ben's not in this panel because he's referenced, but I imagine, okay, what if we're seeing all four of them through these three panels? And that means that this is Sue and Reed. Mm. Now, yes, I agree that possibly, and I mean, neither of them have a feminine form necessarily, but they're all wearing these spacesuits. So it's hard to tell, but I like the idea that the first figure, the figure that says that Ben was right, that the figure eating crow is Reed, because he looks like such a tangle of limbs. So subtly, like the other ones, Johnny's going to start smoking. That's, you know, a clue to what his powers is going to be. And Ben is super heavy, which is also a clue as to what his powers are going to be. So here it's more subtle. Nobody has a transformation, but if this would be Reed, he's just a tangle, a mess of limbs, which might clue us into his bending powers later. Mm. The other figure, you can't see the face, is hidden across the panel to the border. We don't see it. So the invisible girl might be an idea here, but I don't know why her head would be pounding as it's about to burst. You know, like that dialogue does not relate to any of the powers necessarily.
But if we break out of the confines of the context, and to give yours more credence than mine, in the panels that follow, only Sue is holding her head.
Oh, there you go. Like you're looking at the whole thing now, yeah.
Yeah, I am inclined to go with you.
And it's a clue. Nobody knows it, including the writer and artist, but it's a clue as to her powers being a little more mental, like the force field powers that come much later. So that's interesting. I also wanted to talk about that big piece of equipment that we see, you know, in the front. Does that have a purpose, is my question, in the image?
It's Kirby tech, so no.
I mean, you know, elsewhere in the rocket seems like really close confines, and they're kind of stacked in these chairs, and then suddenly when the rays hit, they're bouncing around like it's an open room. But I think out of context, this is kind of the what says we're in an interior, that this is inside the ship, because they're wearing helmets. They just look like their heads are just bubbles. You know, they don't even have like human heads on this that we can tell. We're not in space. Like the rays are not hitting them in some sort of pink space. We are inside, and probably it balances. It helps, you know, with the equilibrium of the piece itself in terms of composition. You've got, you know, that piece down there that creates a depth. You know, like the machine is in between us and the people, and the blue versus the red, you know, creates something there. I think it looks better in the original where the blue is darker.
Yeah.
Because it creates the illusion of shadow beyond just the inking.
See, what I also found interesting about it is in the Hulk, he's clearly being bombarded with gamma radiation. And in Spider-Man, he's bitten by the spider that gives him his powers. The cosmic rays go through them. That's interesting. They're not striking them. The cosmic rays are going through them. Or certainly that's the implication from this panel.
Although we don't see anything penetrate anyone.
Yeah.
You know, we're seeing like layers of this, of these pills going by, but they just seem to be, it's almost like they're playing it like a wind, you know, a solar wind or something, where they're being buffeted about by this hurricane force. That's what it kind of looks like.
Yeah. I mean, earlier on, again, to go out of context, they do say the rays are only light rays, so it makes sense that it doesn't penetrate them or hit them or whatever. But I liked that, again, just contextually looking on it, this panel, I like the idea that the rays are going through them. And as it goes through them, that's what's causing the changes. But the dialogue also makes it clear of the body horror element that's going on, which was a big part of early Marvel. Like, they don't really emphasize it much in Spider-Man, other than him having a mild headache. But certainly the Hulk, he screamed and he was still screaming 6 hours later, I think, is the dialogue. And it's the same here. Whatever this is doing to them is painful. This isn't Barry Allen. And this was a major difference between Marvel and DC. This isn't Barry Allen being caked with chemicals and suddenly he's got superpowers and everything's wonderful and great and marvelous. This is painful. Whatever it is they're enduring here, my head is pounding as though it's about to burst. That's as powerful a line as, and 6 hours later, he was still screaming. There was a horror element to the early Marvels, which made sense because Stan Lee had come from the horror comics line that he did a lot of with Steve Ditko. So there's that element to it as well that is in just a presence in this panel. Whatever this is that's happening to them is painful.
Mm-hmm. And we've got the blood red, which the red alert, but the blood red kind of color on them. And the pose is creepy. Like, this is a pose you could see Spider-Man in. So there's like that creepy pose where it's not like a muscled heroic figure. If it's Reed, whether it's Reed or Sue or whoever, they are not muscled or it's not like a skin tight suit. They kind of look, you know, like a thin figure in a baggy suit being whirled around. So, yeah, I think that fits. You've mentioned a lot of other Marvel origins here. So let me ask you this. And I don't know if they did other Maximums, but if this is kind of a project that works well for Marvel going forward, are there other comics that you would like to see in this format, whether specific issues or just artists' work that would be interesting to look at bigger sizes, panel by panel like this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't think this is the best Kirby one that you could pick, honest. I mean, I know it's historical, but I certainly think this Man, This Monster would be a better pick for this. I think the last issue of Dark Phoenix, I'd love to see John Byrne and Terry Austin's art examined like this. Any issue of Marvels, I think, would look absolutely fantastic if you blew it up like this. They were the ones that came immediately to mind when you asked me the question before we started recording, so I'll go with my gut instinct. Certainly any Alex Ross project, really.
Yes, I think there are some artists that would withstand this kind of scrutiny and, you know, the George Perez's of this world and that this would work with, well, depending, because I don't... The way that the layouts are done, like George Perez, the way he lays out a lot of like the Teen Titans or whatever, or Crisis, I don't think that works panel by panel because the panels are inset into other panels.
Yeah, you'll have like a big splash, won't you? And within that splash, you'll have lots of different panels.
Right. So I think this is kind of the thing that works well with older comics because they were more often in grid form, and maybe there was a little less overlap at times. But I say at times because I was even looking at some Golden Age Jack Kirby this week, and he was doing what Quality Comics was doing a lot of in one of the competing companies, which is elements that, like the old Guardian stories, Newsboy Legion, you could have somebody's foot in the panel below them, and you know there was a lot of crossover between panels, which makes a panel by panel dissection on the page difficult because there are always intruding elements. Anyway, maybe people at home, you're listening to this. I'm not forcing you to be at home. You can be anywhere listening to this, but that's fine. But if you have your own ideas about what would be a great panel by panel volume, an issue or an artist that you would like to see in the spotlight like this, let us know in the comments, of course. So, Andrew, I think we're at the end of our discussion, but I really want to let you tell people what you're up to these days and where they can find you.
At the moment, I do the Palace of Glittering Delights on twotruefreaks.com, which is just my pop culture ramblings, which could be anything from really popular stuff like Star Trek all the way to stuff that people have never heard of like She-Wolf of London and everything in between. My proudest moment still being covering every issue of Stan Lee's Spider-Man. Michael Bailey and I do the Overlooked Dark Knight, where we still haven't grown out of our Batman phase. And we look at a Batman story and or comic that we think is great, but severely overlooked by the masses. So we'll probably never cover The Killing Joke by that reckoner. And that's pretty much it at the moment. My son and I still do Hey Kids Comics every now and again. It's not an ongoing concern anymore, but the entire back catalogue is available over on Hey Kids Comics. And it's just me and my son talking about comics and having a laugh rather than being serious about them. So if that sounds like something you'd enjoy, go and check those out.
All right, we will. And well, so I'll let you get back to the margins. We'll listen to a short promo and I'll come back with listener feedback on our previous episode.
The Long Halloween, Hush, Dark Knight Returns, The Killing Joke.
These are all Batman stories that have been talked about and talked about countless times over the years.
They are considered classics, and in most cases, that title is fitting.
The thing is, Batman is nearly 8 decades old, and whilst those stories are worth talking about, there are plenty of other Bat comics that are being a tad overlooked.
And that's where we come in. Hi everybody, my name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Andrew Leyland.
Andy and I decided that it was a crime that there were so many great Batman stories out there that weren't getting their due.
To that end, we started a show, the Overlooked Dark Knight, a non-index index show. The show can be found at the Fortress of Baileytude Podcasting Network, which is located at www.fortressofbaileytude.com. Shining a bat signal on the bat stories that no one seems to remember or care about.
Because somebody has to.
Now your feedback, comment by comment. Our previous episode was in March of last year, and we went the furthest back we'd ever gone. A little Nemo strip from 1910. Martin Gray was my guest. Well, Chris Franklin was first out of the gate, saying fun discussion. I think I learned about Little Nemo through osmosis, mostly. There were references I caught before I knew what they were referencing, like Tom Petty's Running Down a Dream video, the cover of Batman 377, etc. Then somewhere I learned of Winsor McKay, his strip, and his place in animation history, and those odd references made sense. But my exposure to his work has been minimal at best, so I appreciate the shot in the arm. Just beautiful lyrical work we're seeing here, even if it's nightmarish. He also mentions the Boy Scouts. We talked about that. The Boy Scouts were founded in Britain in 1908, so this very well could be a scout uniform Nemo has on. Dr. Ange is next, says great discussion. Not every podcast I learn about comic history and Google search a Dolly painting. In one issue of DC's Beowulf, he meets Little Omen from Nightmareland. A nice homage. Says, always love these. Let me know if you need a slot filled. I think this is a good summertime podcast, so I might call you after all. Davides Gutierrez, on the other hand, is always on us to cancel this show. Says, this thing's a thing now, eh? And, of course, it was the last one for more than a year, but I always felt that a panel-by-panel was a good avenue for shorter podcasts when time has run out on me, when people don't have as much time to listen, or in my case, to edit. It's also great for people who've never podcasted before and just want a little tryout. It's been paying dividends. Our friend Max Traver first premiered on this little show and now has his own podcast about weird war tales. You might want to check that out. And finally, Jack Bond says, big Little Nemo fan, but McKay sure could have used a letterer. Maybe even some scripting help, as all the speech patterns seem a little awkward. But I'm sure the words were secondary to him. I've only ever seen one page I would call dialogue-driven. So that's it for this show. I will remind you that if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FWPodcasts. And my thanks again to my guest, Andrew Leyland. Until we refill that seat, the panel is open.